Gather round, children, listen. Let me tell you a story about a village that is built with his glory. No sorrow in this place. Just lift your voice and say,
good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Village Celebration Radio Show. I'm Vicki Newton. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We are celebrating for sure in the Village tonight, an historic vote on Capitol Hill. The five-month battle to choose President Barack Obama's next attorney general came to a close today. Finally, and we do mean finally, the Senate voted to confirm Loretta Lynch. The 56-43 vote means Lynch becomes the first African-American female attorney general in U.S. history, succeeding Eric Holder. Republicans refused to bring her nomination up for a vote, as you know, until Democrats cut a deal on some abortion language in an unrelated bill. This had gone on for 5 months. That legislation passed yesterday. That set the stage for today's vote, and it ended the standoff. And again, the Senate confirming Loretta Lynch as the next attorney general by a vote of 56-43. Ms. Lynch's father was in the Senate gallery watching the vote take place, and he said, quote, "The good guys won. That's what has happened in this country all along," he added. "Even during slavery, Levi Coffin was a founder of the Underground Railroad. And even during slavery, a white man fought against slavery. So all over this land, good folks have stood in the right lane, in the right path." And again, as he said, the good guys have won. We're celebrating in the Village. We're glad you're here to join the celebration, and we will be right back with an interview with Rodney Leon, the architect of that new fantastic memorial at the United Nations that has been dedicated to commemorate the millions who died in the brutal transatlantic slave trade. That when we return, so stay right where you are.
My daughter made me this cute bottle with a little water in it. Until I can quit smoking, I can stop flicking cigarette butts and put them in here when I drive. They're litter, plain and simple. This is my way to help keep Arkansas beautiful.
For every ton of paper we recycle, we save 17 trees. I really like trees. Recycling helps keep Arkansas beautiful.
A message from the station.
The Arkansas Broadcasters Association.
And keep Arkansas beautiful.
Nations commissioned a stunning memorial to honor millions brutalized by the slave trade. And we are really excited about tonight's guest, the architect of that monument, Rodney Leon from New York City. Mr. Leon, thank you for joining us here in the Village.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell me about the memorial you designed, because I've read about it, and I can't wait to see it in person. But what strikes me in your comments is that you designed a monument, a memorial, that people can touch. Why is that important?
Yes, we have the monument, which is called the Ark of Return, which was commemorated and unveiled last month on March 25th, actually. And that memorial is meant to be an interactive piece that people can not only like look at, but are meant to pass through and to interact with in a kind of intellectual way and also kind of like physical and a spiritual way. So we felt that it was important for that to happen so that there can be, for the user and for the visitors, something that they can take with them in terms of their personal experience when they pass through the memorial that will allow them to then really reflect upon the tragedy of the transatlantic slave trade and to be able to then pass on whatever they've learned to other people and to take that with them moving forward. So that interactive quality was something that we really wanted to introduce in the memorial. We've done that in a few different ways. There are three parts of it which are specifically more interactive. One is like a map that has the continent of Africa centered on it with the locations of 66 places along that African continent where most of the people were taken from and brought to different places throughout the world. And we also have in the memorial space a sculpture of a figure which is lying inside the memorial that is sculpted out of marble as well as African Zimbabwe granite. And that figure has an outstretched hand reaching out to people. Once they pass through the space, they'll be able to be see that figure and kind of walk up to it and touch it.
And the outstretched hand represents?
Well, it represents kind of like, I think, trying to make a physical connection. The figure is a representation of the lost men, women, and children. Mm-hmm. So it was designed and sculpted by people that we were able to meet who are the master sculptors that we were able to convince to work with us, and they came from Carrara, Italy, to help us realize this vision of a figure that represents men, women, and children. So in some ways, it's a young, androgynous figure. Mm-hmm. And that figure also has this tear which comes out of its face that's been integrated into the design as well. So it has a kind of like a water feature that's tied into the figure as well. And the outstretched hand is meant to welcome people as they come into the space of the memorial itself.
I see. The tear.
There's a third element of interaction, which is also a water feature that once you pass beyond the figure, there's an element of a reflecting pool, mm-hmm. which is at basically table level that allows you to touch the water and allows you to treat it as a kind of like a cleansing or some type of spiritual kind of experience for you once you pass through the memorial. So that's like a third element of interaction. So there's kind of like the sight, the touch, and the sound is all sense of experiences that you pass through when you go into the memorial.
That is a daunting task, to capture the emotionality of such a brutal time in world history, the transatlantic slave trade. What part of the memorial is most moving for you?
I would say that the figure, that Trinity figure, the man, woman, and child figure, is probably the most moving. It really anchors the space inside of the memorial, and it really starts to allow people to then reflect upon that aspect of humanity that I think often gets lost with purely abstract memorials. A memorial has a lot of abstract qualities to it, modern qualities to it, but at the same time, I think the powerful aspect of that figure laying within this kind of triangular niche and illuminated brings a sense of, I think, power that really kind of like brings the whole thing home, so to speak.
You say that it was important to you to be part of this project because it allows an education, if you will, of future generations, so it doesn't happen again. And that the theme of it, as you say, is the Ark of the Return. Tell us how that figures into your determination to play a role in this never happening again.
Well, the Ark of Return has been created around the theme of three, which came out of the competition's desire to reinforce the theme of acknowledging the tragedy, considering the legacy, lest we forget. Mm-hmm. And this aspect of being able to create an Ark of Return really came out of our process of studying the transatlantic slave trade and seeing the maps of this triangular slave trade and starting to become influenced by them, and looking at also the drawings of slave ships and how people were taken and treated as kind of cargo within these slave ships and having to travel across vast distances over very long periods of time in the bottom of these slave ships. And we felt that these experiences can be in a way acknowledged, but also hopefully overcome. Mm-hmm. And we decided that we were going to create an Ark of Return where people originally were taken from their homes and from their families through places like slave castles in the West Africa, never to return. There's actually a place called the Door of No Return off an island in the coast of Senegal, a very famous slave castle, which has a place called the Door of No Return. And we decided that we were going to create a vessel, a ship or space, if you would, that is influenced by the idea of ships and a place where people can then think about the tragedy, consider its impact, and learn about it so that they can communicate that to future generations and educate that young people and others so that we can limit the impact of this type of tragedy happening again in the future. And at the same time, acknowledge that there are people that are suffering similar conditions right now in the world. And insofar as this monument really acknowledges the tragedy of the past and considers that legacy, it also is meant to be a monument that deals with also the contemporary aspects of slavery and of oppression, especially in regards to like what's happening with child slavery and sexual exploitation and trafficking and a lot of the other things that we've been hearing about in the news and in places like in northern Nigeria with the kidnapping of young girls and those kinds of situations is still existing. So, you know, that aspect of it still is alive and we need to continue to acknowledge that and communicate that and educate people so that we can continue to combat, you know, this scourge on humanity.
Well, it certainly will have been a tremendous success, if nothing else, that it just reignites the conversation about, as you say, slavery, which is ongoing, but particularly the transatlantic slave trade, which we don't discuss very much in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that oftentimes we don't have a mechanism, especially for communicating that and educating young people about it. And my hope is that the Ark of Return acts as a means to be able to communicate that history in a way that doesn't engender shame, but engenders a certain level of respect and understanding, so that we can transcend some of the historical, I think, tragedy and some of the remnants of that are both psychological and emotional and cultural and political. So having a place like this at the United Nations and in New York City, I think, is a great location for it because so many people around the world either pass through here, and it, I think, reminds them of the transatlantic slave trade in terms of its impact as a kind of humanitarian, historical tragedy of a great magnitude. But it also reminds them that, you know, of their our responsibilities collectively in terms of like what we're going to do as citizens of humanity, and take responsibility for our fellow human beings that are also suffering in other conditions currently.
Okay. Rodney Leon joining us from New York, the architect of the Ark of Return Memorial at the United Nations. We appreciate you joining us, and congratulations on a phenomenal contribution to world history.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, I can't believe that.
Nice.
I hit it perfect.
You're just standing too close to the ball.
After you hit it.
Hey, you had one in the rough, two in the trees.
We're keeping score?
Yeah.
Maybe a new course would lower your handicap. Arkansas State Parks has two golf courses.
Yeah?
We should play them.
Tell me more.
The Gray Lake Resort's golf course is perfect for us. 18 holes overlooking the lake, and the wives will enjoy DeGray's Island Lodge.
Sweet.
Yeah, then we'll play the ridges at Village Creek.
Village Creek State Park has a course?
Yeah, here it's outstanding. 27 holes, Andy Dye design,
wow.
PGA caliber championship layout, and dramatic elevation changes since it's on Crowley's Ridge.
Wow.
And the girls will enjoy the cabins.
How do we get on these courses?
Well, they're in our state park, so they're public courses.
Yeah.
ArkansasStateParks.com has details and photos.
Let's finish this round and Book a tee time?
Oh, yeah.
Sponsored by this station, the Arkansas Broadcasters Association, and your Arkansas State Parks.
You know, Maya, you're really good in the sciences, and you're good with people also. Have you ever considered being a doctor?
Maybe just a little bit. My aunt was a surgeon.
Ah, surgery is an option. But did you know that family doctors are going to be leading healthcare in the future?
Arkansas needs family doctors. Family doctors see a variety of patients and conditions, focusing on prevention that saves lives. Family medicine, leading the healthcare team.
A message from this station, the Arkansas Broadcasters Association and UAMS.
Wife told me to get a hobby. My doctor told me to exercise. I listened to me. Grow flowers, vegetables, and in my own way, keep an Arkansas beautiful.
For every ton of paper we recycle, we save 17 trees. I really like trees. Recycling helps keep Arkansas beautiful.
A message from the station.
The Arkansas Broadcasters Association and keep Arkansas beautiful.
Thank you for joining us tonight for the Village Celebration. Our lead story tonight, Loretta Lynch confirmed as the first African-American female attorney general in U.S. history. And we certainly hope our new attorney general will continue to focus on and investigate police-involved killings of African-American men, just like Eric Holder has done. Maria Hamilton of Milwaukee is one of the organizers of the Million Moms March. Her son, Dante, was shot and killed by a police officer. She and other mothers around the country who have similar stories are on a mission.
You got it. England.
Well, obviously, we are having some technical difficulties with our report on the Million Moms March, but it's slated for Mother's Day weekend, which we all know is in May. And Maria Hamilton has been quite busy the past few days. She and I spoke on Tuesday, and she was in meetings with clergy in Milwaukee, all to organize this nationwide march with supporters and, of course, mothers who have suffered an unimaginable loss, the deaths of their sons at the hands of police. So we are trying to schedule an interview with her in and around her busy schedule. So hopefully she can join us via phone next week here in the Village. Meanwhile, you know, we have our Village Verse, because one of the enduring legacies of the African-American community is our faith. And so each week we invite a different minister to join us to talk about his or her favorite verse. And we were so happy to have Pastor Cedric Jones from Friendly Temple Missionary Baptist Church in St. Louis. He talks about enjoying the gift of life and that each day is a blessing. Welcome back. We are so glad you're with us for another edition of the Village Celebration. You know, we love the Village Verse, and we are delighted to have joining us today Pastor Cedric Jones from Friendly Temple Missionary Baptist Church in St. Louis. Pastor Jones, or Pastor Ced, as we know you, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What is the verse for us today? Take us to the Word.
Today what the Lord laid on my heart was Psalms 118:24. And it reads, "This is the day which the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." That's the verse.
We will rejoice and be glad in it. It sounds so simple, but there are days where I don't know that I feel like rejoicing. What do you do on those days?
Yeah. On those days, you know, you really have to really think about and meditate on really who is in control of the day. The three things that really come to mind when I think about a verse like this, that we ought to acknowledge the Lord on the day, because this day is not promised to us. He has blessed us to have a day. Amen. We take so much for granted, but each day is a gift from God. We acknowledge Him on today. We adore Him on today. And we appreciate Him on today. Mm. And those are the three main things that I think about. And the circumstances really don't determine all of that. It's really about who we serve, who we know, and who's in absolute control of the day. That's what it's really all about.
Oh, I think
we're going to have those days.
I think that's beautiful.
We're going to have those ups and down days.
So we are to separate the circumstances from who God is.
Absolutely, because God is, you know, He's the source and sovereign of the day. You know, He is in absolute control of the day and all that happens in that day. No matter what we go through, what we encounter, what we experience, everything must first filter through His hand. And when we know that He has the day and we are in that day that He has gifted us with, that we know that we're in His hand as well and that all shall be well. We're in a win-win-win situation.
Mm-hmm. So,
and then when we think about it, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that when we think about that, you know, and then when we get to, you know, the psalmist says, this is the day the Lord has made. So we acknowledge Him on this day. And then it says, let us, or rather, we will rejoice. That's a determination. You know, mm-hmm. You make a choice. It's not, I might. but we will. We are determined. We shall. We'll make mm-hmm. that choice. To rejoice in the day, which means that we adore Him. We think, mm-hmm. we lay all that other stuff aside and then we focus on Him and think about all that He is and all that, you know, all that He's about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we adore Him. Mm-hmm. We will rejoice. We will worship. We will praise Him today because today is not promised to us. And yet, by His grace and mercy, we are spared, we are preserved in order to draw closer to Him and to get it right today. We own God, you know, every, you know, in Lamentation it says His mercies, you know, uh-huh. are renewed every morning. Great is His faithfulness. So each mm-hmm. day that we get up, it's a blessing. And by the way, this particular psalm, the backdrop of it, you know, it really has to do with, you know, the Exodus experience, the day of deliverance. And,
mm-hmm.
and this whole psalm speaks of God's everlasting mercy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that mercy is giving us what we don't deserve and not giving us what we do deserve.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mercy.
Mm-hmm. And that is such a precious gift. And I like that because it puts it in a perspective that at least I can understand it. Maybe it will help others as well. How many times do you receive a gift and then act as if you didn't want it? So this day is a
right.
gift. How dare we act as if we don't want this gift?
Amen. Amen. Because one thing about a gift, we don't have to receive a gift. You know, people don't have to do anything for you.
Amen.
You know, and a gift is just that. You know, you know, you don't earn the gift. You know, gift is not owed you,
uh-huh.
But a gift is something that is given freely
mm-hmm.
because someone has a heart to give you a gift. And God, you know, His mercy and grace,
mm-hmm.
we didn't earn that mercy and grace. Mm-hmm. He doesn't owe us anything. But by his everlasting love and mercy towards us, He gives us the gift based on,
mm-hmm.
Born from His love for us. And so that's why it brings us to the point of appreciating the day.
Mm-hmm.
This is the day the Lord has made. We acknowledge Him. We will rejoice. We will praise Him. We adore Him. And we will be glad in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we appreciate the Lord. We're thankful. We have an attitude of gratitude, a heart of gladness instead of sadness.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're glad, when you get a gift, normally you're glad to receive it.
You're
thankful. You appreciate it. So when we have an attitude like that, and when we think about how, you know, that life is so short, you know, and we look around, you know, I mean, you know, just a few years ago, you know, I had dark hair, you know. Now I look in the mirror, I got some gray in there, you know. Time goes by so fast.
It does.
I look at my child, you know, seemed like I just held him the other day, and now he's looking me straight in my eye, you know.
Right.
The time moves along, it waits on no man. So, you know, each minute, each moment we have, you know, it is a testimony to God's everlasting, steadfast love toward us. And so that's something to appreciate and
it
be glad
is.
About.
It is, and to be glad in it. Boy, you blessed me. I appreciate that. That's a beautiful verse for us in the village. Pastor Cedric Jones from Friendly Temple Missionary Baptist Church in St. Louis. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be right back.
My daughter made me this cute bottle with a little water in it. Until I can quit smoking, I can stop flicking cigarette butts and put them in here when I drive. They're litter, plain and simple. This is my way to help keep Arkansas beautiful.
For every ton of paper we recycle, we save 17 trees. I really like trees. Recycling helps keep Arkansas beautiful.
A message from the station.
The Arkansas Broadcasters Association.
And keep Arkansas beautiful.
No, I can't believe that.
Nice.
I hit it perfect.
You're just standing too close to the ball. After you hit it.
Hey, you had one in the rough, two in the trees.
We're keeping score?
Yeah.
Maybe a new course would lower your handicap. Arkansas State Parks has two golf courses.
Yeah.
We should play them.
Tell me more.
The Gray Lake Resort's golf course is perfect for us. 18 holes overlooking the lake, and the wives will enjoy DeGray's Island Lodge.
Sweet.
Yeah, then we'll play the ridges at Village Creek.
Village Creek State Park has a course?
Yeah, here it's outstanding. 27 holes, Andy Dye design,
wow.
PGA caliber championship layout, and dramatic elevation changes since it's on Crowley's Ridge.
Wow.
And the girls will enjoy the cabins.
How do we get on these courses?
Well, they're in our state parks, so they're public courses.
Yeah.
ArkansasStateParks.com has details and photos.
Now let's finish this round and book a tee time.
Oh, yeah.
Sponsored by this station, the Arkansas Broadcasters Association, and your Arkansas State Parks.
So we're back in the village, and we're glad you're with us this Thursday night. You know, we had a little bit of a glitch earlier when we were talking about the Million Moms March, but things have resolved themselves thanks to the wizards at the board. So here is our report about the Million Moms March. Okay, maybe they're not wizards after all, because it didn't work this time. So I'm not sure, but let's just blame it on the internet, okay? We will have Maria Hamilton next week to tell you more about the Million Moms March and the purpose of holding a march and once again galvanizing Americans, especially African Americans, to continue the pressure on improved police relations in our community. So what should we do now? Let's talk about music and African-American music. When you think Nashville, Tennessee, you don't necessarily think R&B, you don't think gospel, you think country music. But there is much more to Nashville than meets the ear. Village Celebration reporter Glenn Abbott takes us on a road trip.
Don't call it the Music City for nothing.
Watching your smile light up the sky like a fireworks show on the 4th of July.
From your arrival at the airport to the clubs lining Lower Broadway's Honky Tonk Row.
Love Awake.
From the street corners to the balconies of the Grand Ole Opry. The story of Nashville is the story of music.
Nashville's pretty much the hottest music scene in the world right now. I mean, if you look at all the
people think of it as a country music capital, but it's much, much more than that. If you look at the rock side of things that are here, the gospel side of things that are here, the Christian side of things that are here, and also the countryside and the burgeoning urban side, it's all here right now.
Nashville came to be called the Music City because of the Fisk Jubilee Singers.
Probably the earliest influence on music was African American with the Fisk Jubilee Singers touring the States and then touring Europe. And the Queen of England, Queen Victoria, heard them playing and was so taken with them that she said, y'all must truly come from the Music City of America. And that was when we got our first nod as Music City.
The group formed in 1871 at historically African American Fisk University. Still in existence today, the Singers made their mark touring the country and the world, performing to raise money for the university. Nashville is also home to Meharry Medical College, one of the country's oldest and largest historically African American medical schools, founded after the Civil War to train black physicians. Today's Nashville is a modern city, but it hasn't forgotten its roots. From the historic Ryman Auditorium, former home of the Grand Ole Opry, to the Schermerhorn Symphony Center, music is still Nashville's heart and soul. While there's lots more to Nashville than country music, there's no doubt that country is king here.
I mean, we have a great foundation of country music, and that's really what got Nashville started, got us on the map. And we still have great country music, but it's grown into so many other genres.
A visit to the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum is a real chart topper. You'll find gobs of guitars, mountains of music memorabilia, and a couple of over-the-top cars of the stars. While you're there, you can also take a look at the headquarters of Hatch Showprint, one of the oldest letterpress print shops in the country, where they still print concert posters the old-school way.
We're perpetually retro. As I like to think, you know, we're carrying on a craft and a tradition that has been eclipsed by time, but is recognized by many as something that they miss. That tactile feel of the ink on the paper and the slight wear of wood type or metal type versus the super flat world that we live in of digital print or offset print.
And it's all done under the watchful eye of a shop cat, an expert mouser named Mao. Nearby, you'll find the Musicians Hall of Fame and Museum, which showcases everything from country to R&B.
And the music that evolved from the 50s into the 60s and 70s and 80s and so forth, it was just was special, and the way that they recorded it was special because it was all breaking new ground.
On Nashville's Music Row, you can visit RCA Studio B, the city's oldest surviving recording studio.
But by far the grand lady here is this 1942 Steinway piano. It came to Studio B in 1957 when they built the building, and it's never left. It's been in this room all these years. This was Elvis's favorite piano. This was a piano Elvis would play during his jam sessions.
I'm a rambler, shallow gambler.
If you didn't know any better, you might think Nashville was a city full of cowboys, judging by the number of boot shops here.
It's the way to go. If you're in Nashville, you gotta have boots.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Tucked in amongst all those boot shops, you'll find the Johnny Cash Museum in the heart of the city's Honky Tonk District. And it's well worth a visit, a tribute to the legendary Man in Black, with music and memorabilia from his lengthy career.
Let's just make it love, take each other's hands.
The nighttime neon is pretty impressive along Honky Tonk Row. But to really experience Nashville's vibrant singer-songwriter culture, you've got to check out the Bluebird Cafe, an unassuming club in a nondescript strip mall on the outskirts of town. It's an intimate spot where you'll hear singers performing the songs as they've written them.
Let's just make it love.
The Bluebird Cafe is a one-of-a-kind place. I've never experienced anything like it anywhere else. It's really like going into somebody's living room and just being able to be a fly on the wall while three or four songwriters sit in the middle of the room and just play the songs as they wrote them. and you hear, for better or worse, because most of the songwriters are not necessarily the caliber of artists who ultimately will record those songs, but you get to hear the authentic and real performance from the author, and so mistakes and all.
There's a lot more to Nashville than music, of course. The city's Centennial Park contains the world's only full-size replica of the Parthenon, built for Tennessee's 1897 Centennial Exhibition. There's also a vibrant food truck scene here, and these guys were among the pioneers.
One of the great things about it is that when we started, we couldn't define what we would be in terms of the types of food. You know, there's always a burger truck or there's a mac and cheese truck, but we did everything. We looked at it from the point of view that we wanted to do food that was good. It didn't matter where it was from or how it was made.
Nashville is full of creative people, and I mean, when you have Music City means creative, and it means that there's a community of artists and artisans. So food, music, all of these things, when people decide to be creative, Nashville is a wonderful place for that, and that's where we found our home in that sense, to take creativity and make music with our food.
I see faces in the crowd, I think they're laughing out loud.
And where there's music, there's gotta be moonshine.
At Short Mountain Distillery, an hour southeast of Nashville, you can get a taste of some old-fashioned moonshine.
This here is the Cooper Cave Spring. We use this cave spring to get the water for our moonshine. And the man who owned this farm before us over 100 years ago was a moonshiner named Cooper Melton. And he used to sell to Al Capone. So the water that we use to make our moonshine used to supply all the speakeasies in Chicago during Prohibition, all their alcohol.
And it's good stuff. Take it from me and from someone else who should know.
Back when I was a kid, I used to watch a skill for a man, but it's made a lot different today than it was then. But still, it was good moonshine, you know, regardless. It was made good and quite a bit stronger.
Near Murfreesboro is the site of Stones River National Battlefield, one of the Civil War's bloodiest conflicts.
Stones River National Battlefield here commemorates the battle that took place here in Murfreesboro during the holiday season, December 31st through January 2nd. It really was one of the turning points of the war itself, as each one of the sides is trying to take control of both the railways and the waterways, the rivers. And so here in Murfreesboro, the Union armies were able to get control of both the railroad and the waterway.
And African American troops played a major role in the conflict.
Here in Murfreesboro, African Americans were significant in the establishment and building of the National Cemetery, Fortress Rosecrans, which became the supply depot after the battle here in Murfreesboro, served as the supply depot then for troops as they moved on to Chickamauga and Chattanooga.
Moving right along, at open mic night at Puckett's Grocery, a place you can buy Cheetos and toilet paper along with burgers and barbecue, you never know what you're going to find. It's the kind of place where the guy who serves up your food also delivers some killer blues. May find a couple of crazy white guys beatboxing to Baby Got Back.
Give me two side pins, don't sit up. But please don't lose that butt. Some suckers want to play that hard role and tell you that the butt ain't gold.
Or it just may be the keyboards player for the Judds having a little fun.
I'm excited, man, because I feel like it's a part of the process. Country music is progressing. It's progressing, yet being involved in the Judd world, you recognize where it starts from first. Man, I feel so stinking honored.
Whatever your musical taste, there's something for everyone in Nashville. Y'all come back now, you hear? For the Village Celebration, I'm Glenn Abbott.
Sounds like a road trip. You might need a road trip to Nashville. How about that? Fisk University, the Jubilee Singers, Fisk, of course, of HBCU fame, put Nashville on the map as a music capital over 100 years ago. Now, that's history, and we're telling it right here in the Village Celebration. By the way, if you want to see those guys beatboxing to Baby Got Back, you can watch this story in the Village. Go to www.thevillagecelebration.com. We're back with more of our radio show and our special Village View essayist, Stacy Baldwin, talking about education.
From the Ozark Mountains to Old Man River, Arkansas's 52 state parks belong to all of us to experience, to enjoy, to remember.
Our family stayed in the Mountain Lodge at Pettigene for the holiday, and no one had to cook. We ate in the lodge. Oh, the view over the canyon. Oh, and those huge fireplaces. Oh, the chocolate pies.
I remember going to the lodge on the Gray Lake. The park naturalist took us out on a boat, but we'd never seen an eagle in the wild before, and we saw five that day.
The cabin at Devil's Den when it snowed. We went hiking. It was so beautiful. And then we found that journal in the cabin, and we sat by the fire and read stories that the other guests had written. I'll never forget that.
The State Parks of Arkansas. Call 1-888-AT-PARKS for a free guidebook or visit ArkansasStateParks.com. Sponsored by this station, the Arkansas Broadcasters Association, and your Arkansas State Parks. My park, your park, our parks.
It's a Thursday, so you know you need to be in the Village. I'm Vicki Newton. So glad you are with us for the Village Celebration Radio Show. A few days ago, First Lady Michelle Obama said that she believes that the civil rights issue of our time is education. There are some, however, who are taking shortcuts when it comes to educating our children. Our guest essayist tonight is Stacy Baldwin with a piece about the Atlanta controversy when it comes to testing school children. Stacy, tell us what you wrote.
Cheating scandal that occurred in Atlanta's public education system is one that I am torn by. If you aren't familiar with the story,
in July of 2011, state investigators found 178 teachers, principals, and administrators guilty at 44 different Atlanta schools. Of that 178, only 80 confessed to the crime. By March of 2013, 21 of the 178 accused educators were reinstated, and another 150 either resigned, retired, or lost their appeals. There were originally 35 educators indicted, of which 21 chose to enter a guilty plea, leaving 13 to stand trial. Of that 13, one dies. Some state that the judge was either harsh, or lacking mercy when given the final verdict. But because of the connection we all have with the title of teacher, it's hard to receive this crime as a criminal act, and we almost forget about the victims, the students. The educators were given several opportunities to lessen their sentence, even after passing the guilty plea deadline. And while they face the judge in court, the judge reopens a plea bargain of which only two of the 12 accept, leaving the 10 to face trial. State investigators believe the cheating dates back to 2001. This trial raises several questions in my mind that I wonder if people have even considered. If the students were failing poorly, but the test scores were remarkably high, where was the parental concern? I understand the protesting against Common Core and other governmental implications that take place within the school, but there was a greater reachable issue. When you deal with Common Core in the state national testing, it's all across America. The issue of students being passed without showing evidence of needing to be moved up to the next level was something that could have been fought within reach, right in Atlanta. If someone in corporate America falsified documents in order to get personal gain, we would be quick to call them con artists and all sorts of names. If someone goes into a convenience store and steals something, we don't mind that kind of conviction. Since these are educators, and as I stated before, we all can connect with them, it's easy to see them as innocent. I understand jobs were at stake and the state was threatening because of the deficiencies shown in the test scores, but where was the integrity? Why didn't someone seek help from a school system that was successful at governmental regulations? I'm pretty sure there are plenty of schools that have the testimony of having poor test scores, but they went through a recovery process and they didn't shortchange the students. Let's look at it this way. Either walk your integrity and lose your job because students are filling with the possibility of finding another one, or deceive and lose everything, job, trust, respect, licensure, and possibility of ever teaching again, jail times, fines, etc. Educators are held to a standard of professionalism that most aren't even in professional careers aren't held to because they mold future generations. And if educators are shortchanging our students of the necessary education to truly advance to the next level of life, then they have shortchanged the whole future of America because the students in those chairs are our future. As declared by the judge, this was not a victimless crime. Mercy was extended three times to these educators, but they decided the mercy of the plea bargain because they wanted what they wanted. They wanted mercy to look like what they wanted it to look like. To have knowledge of such a crime and to do nothing makes you guilty. In the fifth grade, we were rewarded with books for various reasons, and at the end of the semester, we could go to the school store and get whatever we wanted with our books. They had all kinds of toys and treats and gifts you could buy for someone like your mom. One day, a few of my friends decided to steal some of the books from my teacher. The next morning, before the bell rang for the school to begin, I went to my teacher in privacy and told him that they were stealing the books because I was taught that stealing was wrong. He didn't violate my privacy, he just adjusted. Although I didn't steal any, my conscience felt the guilt, and I was guilty because of the knowledge I had. So many people are behind prison bars because of being guilty by association. I can't say that these convicted persons are or aren't guilty of changing answers on a test. They may just be guilty by association. Maybe the 10 really purposed in their hearts that they were innocent. But some of it is lack of humility, and they made the choice of how to suffer. The judge simply wanted them to accept some responsibility for their actions, and I believe in taking responsibility, the judge might have let them out more lenient. The judge might have would have been a little bit more lenient than he already was. When someone commits a wrong to you and they refuse to take responsibility, think of how it makes you feel.
That's a good question. How does it make you feel? We're going to take a break and come back and address a couple of the things that you highlighted in your essay. Integrity, our expectations of teachers from years ago and today, and maybe even more important to have integrity today. Also, guilt by association and the education that our children are receiving. It's all being discussed here in the Village. Stay with us.
You know, Maya, you're really good in the sciences, and you're good with people also. Have you ever considered being a doctor?
Maybe just a little bit. My aunt was a surgeon.
Ah, surgery is an option. But did you know that family doctors are going to be leading healthcare in the future?
Arkansas needs family doctors. Family doctors see a variety of patients and conditions, focusing on prevention that saves lives. Family medicine, leading the healthcare team.
A message from this station, the Arkansas Broadcasters Association and UAMS.
Welcome back again to the Village Celebration Radio Show. We just heard from our guest essayist, Stacy Baldwin, who is a preschool teacher. And you selected this topic to discuss because education is critical. The First Lady says it is the civil rights issue of today. And we hear so often about our children being shortchanged. This cheating scandal in Atlanta. Lack of integrity on the parts of the teachers, you say?
Yeah, I do think it's lack of integrity on the parts of the teacher, because if you have knowledge of something that's going on that's affecting the students and they aren't growing from this, then where's your integrity in that? You're affecting lives that are going to be molding our future pretty much.
So the teachers, do you think, chose their personal success over the long-term success of the students?
I do think that they chose their personal success over the long-term success of the students. It was a selfish thing to do when you have the power in your hand to make a change and you don't do anything with it, then yeah, it's a selfish motive behind it.
You know, it brings to mind that quote, and I hope I get it right, or at least close to it, that evil thrives when good men do nothing. And so those who were aware of the scandal, perhaps many of them did not say anything. And to illustrate that point, you chose an example from your childhood, mm-hmm. where you saw some wrongdoing and you were brave enough to speak out about it. I don't know that many people would have that type of courage. Can you go back to that time when, as a little girl, you thought, wait a second, this is wrong, and right one out?
Yeah, It happened because my teacher, he left the, they were called biller books, and he left them sitting in the drawer. They were easy access. And so one day we came in the classroom and he wasn't in there. We were in there looking for him. But a couple of the people that I were with, they saw the books and they grabbed them some. And I was looking like, I don't think I want to get that. And so I didn't say anything. And so I was like, I don't know what to do, but I knew that I should go tell someone.
How old were you?
I was in the fifth grade.
Okay.
I was in the fifth grade. About that time, you're about 10, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so,
did it occur to you at all? Did you have that split second where you thought, oh gosh, I could get some special things from the store if I had just a few more books?
No. No, it
didn't.
That's
wonderful.
I guess my mother, she kind of put the moral sense in me. And so it's kind of like it was just automatically, this is wrong. And
I'm telling it.
Yeah. I don't think it occurred to me at first to like go and tell him.
Right.
But then like I guess overnight the guilty conscience kind of got to me.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. You thought, okay, you know, you sit there and then you do that back and forth. There's the little angel on one shoulder and the
yeah.
little guy with the pitchfork on the other shoulder. But in the end, you did share with your teacher and he honored your trust.
Mm-hmm. He did. He did.
In him.
He mm-hmm. didn't give me any more Biller books, but he looked like he was a little upset about it.
Well, I can imagine.
Yeah.
I can imagine that he was. Arrogance on the part of the teachers when it came to accepting the plea bargain? What do you think? How would you describe the decision not to plea bargain or to just push it all the way through or at least attempt to do so?
And that's something that I really can't understand because, you know, they kept pleading and asking for mercy. But when I looked at the case, I was kind of like, he did offer something to them. And it's kind of like, if he's not going to go any further, why not accept the mercy that he's already extending to you? And even the judge said no one accepted responsibility for their actions. So it's kind of like, even in that, you're asking for mercy, but you're not accepting the responsibility for what actually went on within the schools that you have knowledge of. So I just think that it's kind of like, if you're not willing to admit some wrong in the case, then it's a sense of arrogance. I do think that.
The students in Atlanta and all around the country are tested frequently.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of pressure on teachers, there's a lot of pressure on students. In the midst of all of that back and forth, is the real possibility that very little education is being taught. Do you see that as a preschool teacher? How does a teacher balance the demands and just the need to actually teach and make sure students are learning?
Because of the high level of testing that goes on within classroom, because right now classroom teachers are preparing students for the test
and the Common Core and all of that.
Yeah, and they're implementing more and more testing. So I think it's a hard balance, and it does put a lot of strain in on teachers. So I do think that the state should like back up a little bit. excuse me, Sam, but I think that it's a hard balance to actually teach the kids what they actually need to learn in life and to actually meet the state requirements. Because sometimes the state requirements don't always show or actually prove what students actually know. Because I would say the testing is kind of straight all across the board, like from Atlanta to here in Arkansas or wherever it is.
A lot of these tests are standardized
standardized.
They're able to evaluate students nationally with these standardized tests.
But if it was catered to the actual classroom, then maybe it could be a little bit better instead of it. Because the Atlanta public education system doesn't look like everywhere else. It looks different, but the same test is administered to everyone.
Well, so that is certainly a discussion that we could have for many, many weeks here in the Village. And maybe we will do that in terms of having a roundtable discussion and bring in some more teachers and some administrators to talk about the education our children are receiving and these expectations, the federal guidelines, No Child Left Behind, Common Core, and all of the standardized expectations. I think we just hit on a new idea for a future Village Celebration radio show. Stacey Baldwin, thank you so much for joining us to share your thoughts about the cheating scandal in Atlanta. And thank you for joining us for the Village Celebration radio show. Hey, please go to Facebook and like us, thevillagecelebration.com. Like us on Facebook, and then we have a Village Celebration radio show Facebook page. Conversation, connection, and community. all of it right here in the Village, and you're a part of it, and we thank you for it. Good night. I'm Vicki Newton, and we'll look for you next Thursday.
Joy Network.
You're amazing.
You're amazing.
You're amazing.
You're amazing.
You're amazing.